So the basic idea in mindfulness practice is to train ourselves to pay attention to what's happening in the present moment. And one of the things that becomes all too obvious to many of us as we try to do that is how easy it is for the mind to wander off from the present moment, to get caught up in our thoughts and concerns, past and future. And sometimes we consider these things to be distractions. I'm trying to stay with my breath, I'm trying to stay with the present moment, and I'm distracted by memories of a conversation I had earlier today, or by my plans for tomorrow, or all kinds of things we might. But it's very, very it's worth investigating a little bit the nature of attention. Our attention goes to what we're most interested in. And distractions are just things that we're very interested in. Somehow, maybe not in the surface mind. Maybe the surface mind, which we think maybe is supposed to run the show, thinks that X is interesting. But there's often undercurrents within us that think what's really important, what's really interesting is something else, entirely different. And part of what we do in mindfulness practice is to become interested and sensitive to what are the things that we're interested in besides the present moment. What are the so-called distractions? What are some of the so-called things which get in the way and make it difficult for us to be in the present moment? So rather than just kind of noticing we've been lost and then coming back, noticing we're lost, coming back, noticing we've lost and then swearing under our breath a little bit, gee, I did it, I can't get this in the hang of it or whatever, or notice, some wonderful fantasy arises, this most wonderful fantasy you've had all week. And that is a good fantasy. Forget about this mindfulness stuff. And let's just go with that because I deserve a break, a vacation. Maybe you're fantasizing about Tahiti. So part of mindfulness practice, for it to be realistic and kind of useful with our lives, we have to actually include within the mindfulness practice what it is that the forces within us, the tendencies within us, that tend to make us drift away from the present moment, and take that into account. Now, it's a little bit like Aikido, where you kind of use your opponent's force to kind of help you. If there's energy and interest in some direction, in fantasy or in desire and being lost in some little personal vendetta you have with someone or all kinds of things, doubt and thoughts, is if you keep going off in that direction, you want to take your mindfulness and tap into that interest, tap into that energy there that's involved with that, and use that as a place to wake up. Use that as a place to notice what's going on in the present moment. Because if you're thinking about the past, that's happening in the present moment. If you're thinking about the future, that's happening in the present moment. And so you don't have to kind of keep turning away and thinking of these things as obstacles or problems, but you can actually turn yourself into the distractions, so-called distractions, and notice what they are, and in noticing what they are, learn to be present again, learn to be independent of them. So it's kind of like if you're slipping on the banana on the sidewalk. Some of us, have learned that it works best if you're slipping if you kind of go into the fall for a moment. If you kind of fight the fall, then you'd probably fall down. But if you kind of for a moment kind of go with the fall, then you can kind of get your bearings and kind of right yourself and not fall. So what this means is that the very things that make it difficult for us to be present and mindful are not to be seen as problems or obstacles or enemies to your practice, but rather you see them as the food for developing your practice, so the nourishment, they're kind of like the compost or the material by which we strengthen and develop our capacity to be mindful and to look carefully. And this is very important to be told because a lot of new people to meditation will sit down and try to meditate with their breath and notice how difficult it is and then feel like it's either hopeless or feel despairing or feel angry or feel all kinds of things go on. I'm not doing it right, I can't do it. But it's completely human to have distracting thoughts. And so it's much more useful to somehow work with them than it is to kind of always be battling them and fighting them or kind of trying to come back to the breath. Sometimes it's completely unrealistic to stay with the breath because the forces of so-called distractions are so powerful that, you know, you're beating yourself against the wall to try to be with the breath. So to notice what it is that takes you away is part of what is involved in the practice. And then as soon as you notice what's taking you away, you are in the present moment with that. And that's what the practice is, to be in the present moment with what's going on. Are you following me so far? So to help us in this process, the Buddhist tradition enumerates a list of five most common forces within us that make it difficult for us to be present. So learning this list is supposed to make it easier for you to notice these things. And since they're supposedly some of the most common phenomena that come down the way, if you familiarize yourself with this list, then you can kind of be on the lookout for these. And if you kind of know that they're to be looking out for them, you might not be carried away so far with these things, but rather you'll notice them when they first appear. And these five forces are desire, ill will or aversion, sloth and torpor, restlessness, agitation, and doubt. So these five are called the five hindrances. The classic word in Pali is nivarana, which means the five coverings. That which covers over the present, makes it difficult for us to be present because the present moment gets covered, which is very telling because sometimes the function of the five hindrances is to prevent us from being in the present moment because we don't want to be in the present moment for a number of reasons. But for sometimes the present moment is not a very attractive place for people to be. Sometimes if people feel very scared and vulnerable or it's too honest to be in the present moment. You have to kind of deal with suffering, you have to deal with discomfort, you have to deal with love and compassion, and to deal with another person if you're really present. You can watch, go people watching on University Avenue and kind of look at some of the homeless people with the shopping carts there on University Avenue, and then watch how the other people walking down University Avenue treat them, or how they relate to them. And you'll notice it's some people would rather they weren't there, and they kind of like turn down, they focus away. They don't want to really be present for that person for a lot of reasons, but often we turn away because we're uncomfortable. So the five coverings. These are very useful to notice when you were doing meditation, to know about these. Doubt. Now these things can operate in meditation on a very large scale, preventing us from meditate to begin with. You say you want to do your daily meditation practice, and it's time for the daily practice, and very overwhelming desire arises for something else. You know, meditation's fine, but gelato is better. You know, it's 7:30 in the morning, and I'm sure I can find some place that's open. Or there's a whole series of, you know, desires that can come into play. You know, I'd like to go for a walk, or maybe, you know, today I'd like to read the newspaper or something. And so the desires can come in, and we can get seduced by those desires so that we follow those instead of following through on our desire to meditate in the morning or whenever we do. Or there can be aversion to something. And aversion can keep us from meditating. Perhaps you're feeling kind of uncomfortable that day. You have a headache or you feel really tense. And you know that if you sit down to meditate, you're going to have to really take stock of that, really feel that. And the last thing you want to do is feel how uncomfortable you are, psychologically, physically, or whatever. And so you have an aversion to being present, to meditation. So I'd rather go do something else to make myself feel better. Gelato. You know, that would do it.
Which category would aversion be?
That's the second one, ill will, aversion. And to have some kind of aversion or ill will, kind of to push something away. I don't want to do that because that's not what I want. Not today. You know, this is not the right time. And then there's sloth and torpor can keep us from meditation because we feel really tired. Sometimes we feel really exhausted and feel like the mind feels like a swamp. You know, the mind can't seem to get anywhere or work in any kind of functional way, or we feel really, really lethargic, lazy, and somehow, oh, not now, I'll do it later, you know. I'll just lay here and look at the television, or, you know, just do something else. And then you watch television for an hour or two, and then you feel even worse. And then the fourth one, which is restlessness, agitation, that can keep people from meditating because you feel so restless and so agitated that it just, you know, you can't sit still. You know, it's like if you try to sit still, it feels like you're at the rodeo. Why would anybody want to sit when you're so restless? You know, you're too restless to even kind of get around to even sitting down. And then the fifth one, doubt. You can be filled with so much uncertainty about what to do. Is this the right time to meditate? Maybe I should have done it earlier. Maybe I should do it later. Maybe I should turn the lights on, turn them off. Maybe I should have a high cushion or a low cushion. Should I have music while I meditate? Should I not have music while I meditate? Should I, you know, uncertainty and doubt about what to do. And it kind of takes over. And we get paralyzed sometimes, or you know, indecisive. We can't make a decision. And in the doubt, well, I can't decide today whether to meditate or not. And so I don't know what I'll do. So these can operate on a very coarse level, but then they can operate at increasingly refined levels in the mind. At the far end of the extreme, the mind can be phenomenally still and quiet. It can be seemingly, it's never been so easy in your life to really be in the present moment. It can feel like you're kind of like, it's like you're a surfer riding a wave, and the wave is the present moment. And you just feel like you're right there for everything. In no way, you know, you're not really going to, there's no easy tendency to slip off into thought, and you're just there and there and there and feel so clear, so wonderful. And so it can feel as high as kind of surfing. I mean, caught the wave, to really have caught the present moment and just be there and not have any tendency to pull you off. Really still, very pristinely clear in the mind, and hardly any thoughts at all, and very joyful, very light and pleasant. And the classic story like this is, you know, where you, it's happened to many people who've practiced a lot on retreat, where you're sitting so, you feel like you're on the brink of enlightenment. You know, it's just really great. Your meditation's going so well. And just, if you could just sit for another little while, certainly you get enlightened. It just feels like you're so close. And then they ring the lunch bell at the retreat center. Oh, lunch. Gotta have lunch, right? So off you go and forget that meditation because lunch is more important. But desires can creep in, or suddenly you're sitting there, things are very clear, and there's a little desire. I wonder if I can make it better. And then the mind starts very subtly scheming and planning. Well, maybe if I just adjust my breath a little bit, I can get even better with this. Or maybe, you know, or aversion arises. You're so pristinely present. You say, oh, if only there wasn't a little extra pressure on my butt while I'm sitting there. That's really getting in the way. And so then so slowly that little aversion to that little bit of pressure or weight in the butt kind of grows, and the mind kind of gets consumed by very subtle thoughts about, you know, aversion or wanting to get rid of that. So in both situations, the mind is in the present, and then it kind of slips off the wave and gets caught up in concerns by that desire, concerns by that aversion. Picks those things up and starts thinking about them and engaging in them and manipulating in order to try to get them. So these five forces can operate at the coarsest level and the most refined levels. They operate in your daily life all the time, and they operate during meditation. They're really common phenomena in human beings. Some Western teachers have been unhappy about calling these the five hindrances, because in their mind the connotation is that they're kind of bad, the five sins, the five terrible things, the five hindrances or whatever. And they're not meant to be considered to be kind of these enemies that we have. They're meant to be just a realistic list of, realistically, if you look at yourself and look at how your mind works, you'll probably notice these things operating. Some days one will operate more than the other. Sometimes desire has the upper hand, sometimes aversion, sometimes doubt. And if we really want to develop the capacity to stay present in a balanced way, we have to learn how to see these things, not as enemies, but as kind of our friends, or as our supports, or as the food, or as maybe our opponent in the Aikido fashion that we're going to kind of go into. And I was told once that in Aikido, you're supposed to love your opponent to death. or something. Love your opponent to defeat or something. So I still don't want to take, you know, the hindrances of the opponents exactly, but the much more friendly attitude to them. Not see them as being problems, but see them as the place where we can develop the capacity to be present. And once we start studying these in meditation, you probably start noticing how they operate in daily life too. And you'll notice how many of us sometimes get pulled around by our nose, by our desire. Our desire has the upper hand. Our anger or aversion has the upper hand. That rather than... I gave a talk yesterday at a church. They asked me to come and speak about anger. And so I showed up there, and there's a big sign in front of the church, and it said, Gil Fronsdal, 10 to 12, working with anger. And I thought that was great, working with anger. So that's what I'm supposed to talk about today, working with anger. And I liked it because the expression was not working against anger. You know, so anger wasn't, you know, considered something to work against. And it wasn't that being worked over by anger, which is how many people are with the anger gets the upper hand. We think we're in charge, but really the anger is in charge, and you say and do things that later you regret. But working with anger implies a kind of working relationship, kind of like you're not quite the anger. That there's a kind of way in which you can kind of see it objectively, something separate from at least your attention or the place where you can make decisions or choices. And so because it's a little bit separate from the place that makes choices and decisions, you can work with it. Now, you don't want to work against it, but you can work with it. Okay, what's wise here to do with it? How do I be present for it? How do I not get caught by it and swept up by it? How do I see it and stay balanced myself in the midst of it? Some people consider these things to be sins. I mean, certain people of certain religious backgrounds will consider any desire kind of sinful almost, or certain desires sinful. There's no notion like that in Buddhism. It's all stuff to be worked with. The goal in Buddhism is to find our independence from these things rather than either attack them or be controlled by them. In order to do that, we study them. We bring our attention to them. I met with a person today who had been doing meditation for a long time. And she seemed to have a very good meditation practice, was from what she told me. But the meditation practice seemed primarily to be one about... This is not what she said. I kind of paraphrase, kind of, you know, just partly just to make it a little bit different so she won't recognize herself if she's here. She focused on just staying calm. You know, she did, you know, sometimes you can get really calm when she meditated. So she just tried to get calm when she sat. And after a while in talking with her, what I learned was that her primary focus was calmness for her meditation. And she completely ignored the rest of her life. She completely ignored her physical sensations in her body, probably her thoughts and, you know, all the other things going on. And sometimes she was able to get calm, and you can also sometimes develop a capacity to get calm, but she hadn't really learned much about her life. She hadn't developed the wisdom, the familiarity with what really makes her tick. So to learn about the five hindrances is to learn kind of what makes you tick. So you really want to take them seriously as objects of meditation, as something to study and pay attention to. So desire. Desire is very seductive, often because desire is pleasant to have desire. It's often very convincing, our desires. Sometimes you feel we get a message from society sometimes that we deserve our desires. Desires are good. We should just act on our desires. It's the advertisement world's dream is to have consumers who have desires and have no limitations on their on their following through on their desires. You know, that'd be great, wouldn't it? You know, right now it's supposed to be the American way to have desire, consume. You know, keep the economy going. So it's good to have desires. And desires are very seductive. In meditation, desires often take the form of fantasy. We don't usually have a desire in the abstract, but the desires often comes with story making, with ideas of what we want. And that story making, that fantasy making, is often seductive because it's pleasant. It has the pleasure of promise, of hope. And some people are addicted to hope. Their life is kind of despairing, and they're really hoping for something. And so they're reaching out into the future for where their life is going to be saved. And so they're not really, that's how it covers the present, that's what kind of, how they ricochet off the present moment, how they fall off the wave. So they're hoping for the future. And so desire kind of then is an expression of that hope. Some people desire more actively as a way to fill some emptiness inside of them. We're feeling sometimes lonely or feeling kind of lack of self-worth or somehow lack of meaning in our life. And so then we're looking for some desire to fill it, some pleasure to fill it. And often addicts, for example, are people who are caught up in the cycles of desire, of wanting. And often what they want is physical pleasure. And there's a confusion between physical pleasure and happiness. And so if you can't really, if your object of addiction is not right in front of you, we can get consumed by our desire. And sometimes that desire is not very pleasant. It can be quite unpleasant to be consumed by addiction. But often it kind of can at its origin sometimes be a kind of cover or kind of an attempt to fill a sense of lack or emptiness within us. Desire often has the characteristic of leaning forward, of wanting something in the future. Sometimes you can feel it in your body. Your body kind of leans forward. It gets a little bit tight as you want things and desire things. Sometimes desire propels us into days and days and days of fantasy. You know, endless fantasy of all kinds. Sexual fantasy, food fantasies, job fantasies, vacation fantasies, all kinds of fantasies, relational fantasies. And we can get lost in this whole world of fantasies, which sometimes have no bearing at all in what's really true. It's all too easy for the fantasy world to be. We have an accurate assessment of how life is, but all too easy, desire fuels fantasy, imaginary ideas of what life is rather than what's real. So one of the things to do in mindfulness practice is to notice when we're desiring, when desire has occurred, when we're caught by the wanting mind. And then to study that, to be familiar with that. Don't just kind of push it off or let go of it the first chance you have, but actually kind of get to know it better. What's it like, this wanting mind? Are some of the things I'm going to be saying about the hindrances about wanting and desiring, is it true in your experience? You know, test it and find out. Maybe it's not true for you. One of the things you might test and find out is when you're caught by desire, how present are you in the present moment? And often the wanting mind is wanting something in the future, maybe just a second in the future or a day in the future, whatever. And that kind of projection of the mind into the future corresponds with a rejection or a shutting down of a full presence, clear presence of what's happening in the present moment. So you might study, you know, what's the role of desire of keeping you really attentive and alert to what's happening right now? And then to bring your attention into your body. It's one of the primary principles of mindfulness, is to come back into your body. Turn your attention back into your body and notice what's happening there as you notice something like desire. And if it's a really powerful desire, you'll certainly feel it. I don't know if I should tell these stories, but maybe you've all had some experience like this, or some of you or something, but of how strong since physical sensations of desire can be. I was going to spend the night in this woman's house. And, I had a girlfriend somewhere else I was kind of committed to, and it was kind of understood to be more or less a monogamous relationship. But I was going to spend the night in the couch in this woman's house. This was a long time ago. And when it was time to go to sleep, she indicated that I was invited to her bed. It was a nice invitation. I said, no, thank you. it wasn't actually so direct, but it was obvious, both the request and my response. And then, so then we went to our respective places to sleep, but she left her bedroom door completely open, which was just right there. Just felt like an open invitation. And then in the middle of the night, she came out and sat down next to me and kind of see how I was. Well, how I was I didn't sleep at all that night. It felt like this tremendous struggle. I couldn't believe the struggle I was in. I mean, I should have been a lawyer. I mean, all the justifications of why I should go in there and it was really physical, this physical urge and push and pull and, conflict within me and stress. And boy, it was exhausting, the most exhausting night I've ever had. And, it was an example of desire. Mostly I was caught by my desire. I had no, other feelings for her. And so that's kind of maybe one extreme end of how it can be. So you can feel it in your body, how it is. And sometimes feeling it in the body can take the power away from the desire, because the body is not a story. The body is not a lawyer that's going to argue the case. The body is just physical sensations. And if you come back into physical sensation, just feel it there, it can be a lot easier to manage. If you're not grounded in your body, then the lawyers sometimes get the upper hand. And off you go to the next room or whatever. But to stay in your body is really one of the primary things you want to do. And not in your body as a way of turning away from the desire, but going in and feeling what the desire it feels like within your body. And then just notice. You can use a mental note. I'm having desire, desire, desire. And just a clear acknowledgement by a simple word repeatedly sometimes can help you be independent of the desire, not caught by it or pulled by it so clearly. The other thing to do with desire is to notice what it's covering. If the hindrances actually mean the five coverings, what does desire cover? What is the emptiness or the hole within you that is you're trying to fill? I like the English expression wanting, because something is wanting when it lacks something. The soup is wanting salt. Sometimes when we're wanting a lot, it's we need something. There's something we need inside of us besides the object. It's like my 3-year-old son. He can be this desire machine at times, and primarily happens when he's tired. You go into a store and he's tired and he wants everything in sight. But there are times when he wants a lot of things, and he doesn't really want the object. He doesn't want the toy or whatever. Sometimes what he wants is he wants love. He wants attention and contact. And so sometimes we just give him that, and then all the desire momentum will fall away. And he's happy again. It can be that way with ourselves, that sometimes the desire is a symptom of some deeper longing, some deeper need within us. And sometimes you can turn your attention and notice what that is, and then act accordingly. Maybe just one of the best offerings you can give is yourself, is your own love. And one of the best forms of love is attention. So one of the things we do in mindfulness is to bring our attention to feel the loneliness, the emptiness that we might feel inside, and not recoil from it, not be afraid of it, but to just bring our attention. Attention is love. And love will heal. Attention will heal these things if we have the courage to hang in there long enough with these holes that we have inside of us. Aversion also can be a covering. For some of the same things. Some people recoil from their own pain and suffering, and it stimulates all kinds of aversion. I know lots of people who feel terrible, this personal discomfort. They don't want to look at it, so their protection from themselves is to blame other people, to judge other people. Part of the functioning for some people, of persistent, ongoing, addictive judgments. Judging is really a form of self-protection. And it's judging sometimes has this aversive quality to it. So sometimes we can turn our attention around and say, where is all this aversion coming from? What's the hole? What's the need? What's it covering up within me? And if you can find that, then you want this love of attention, this attention of love, you can turn and bring it back and really feel that directly. Aversion also is something that can be felt in the body. It's usually not so pleasant. as desire. And some people are much more motivated to be mindful of aversion within themselves than they are of desire, because it's unpleasant for it to be there. However, some people are addicted to their aversion. It adds a kind of energy to their life. It kind of fuels them up, as does, as can desire. I call desire and aversion the caffeine of the soul. Mm-hmm. And in that, we sometimes, some of us become addicted to this kind of caffeine. We have to realize that the process of being mindful, of not giving in to these things, but sitting there and not giving in, sometimes we go through withdrawals in the same way we do with coffee withdrawal. And you have to know that so you have the patience to see it through. If you didn't know that, you might say, well, this is not worth it. I'll just get up and go about my life where I can follow my desires any way I want. So with aversion also, you can feel it in your body. I can't underscore how important and useful it is to drop down into your body and feel your emotions, your motivations, as bodily events. It's one of the primary ways you become free and independent of the story making, which often is pushing us forward, and often free of the intention that's often behind those kinds of feelings.
Could you give an example of aversion?
Oh, it can be so simple as you're sitting here meditating, and it's a little bit uncomfortable on your pillow, and you had this thought, you know, it's uncomfortable, that's fine. But after a while, it gets more uncomfortable. So, this is really uncomfortable. And if I wasn't so uncomfortable, then I could really meditate and get somewhere. But this discomfort is getting in the way. And God, I hate this pillow, because you know this pillow is really preventing me from my desire. My desire is to have a great meditation, and I'm frustrated in my desire. And this pillow is the cause. And God, And then, what would be a great way of killing this pillow? And then the mind gets, I'm going to take it home, and I'm going to go in the backyard, and I'm going to get an axe, and then I'm going to get matches, and I just can't wait to do this pillow in, and you're like lost in these fantasies of aversion. And so what's happened is you've fallen off the wave of the present, and you're caught up in these thoughts and of aversion of what you're going to do to the pillow. Someone coughs in the meditation hall. Oh, that person is interrupting my meditation. How could that person be so disrespectful? How could that person even be allowed in here? They should have a sign on the door that says, no coughing in the hall. And there's that teacher up there. Why doesn't he know there should be a sign up there that says, no coughing in the hall? And and pretty soon, it can spill over, and pretty soon it's like everyone's the butt of your aversion, But it can be the opposite. Sitting there and the pillow is uncomfortable. This is not so nice, and I wish I was more comfortable. And you open your eyes and you notice the person near you is sitting on that looks like a buckwheat cushion. Wow. Wouldn't it be great? Boy, if I could have that buckwheat cushion, it would be really great. What would it feel like? How would you just contour my butt? And it'd feel kind of sensuous. And wow, yeah, and I would look really cool because it was kind of, burgundy. And what would be really, maybe I can get a little, And so the mind gets lost in the desire. So this is how it works. All kinds of things in all kinds of ways. Sloth and torpor can also be felt in the body. And it's very helpful to do that, because then we're not caught by the choices we make when we are filled with sloth and torpor. Some of the choices is giving up. But sloth and torpor, you can also ask the question, what is it covering? And I like the word sloth. For a long time, I thought it was odd these Buddhists use the word sloth and torpor, because we don't use these words usually in English anymore, kind of archaic. But now I like it, and the reason I like it is that it points to something a little bit different than simply being tired. And so we use these unusual words to differentiate. And sloth and torpor often come from resistance. We're resisting something. We really don't want to be present for something. We don't really want to look at something. I call it my Sears mind, because when I was 11, 12 years old, my mother would take me to Sears department store, and I hated it. I hated the smell. I hated looking for clothes. I hated just the whole experience. And as soon as you walk into the store, oh, I'm so tired. I'm so tired. Can we go? And then as soon as we leave, you know, I'd be fine. I'd be peppy again. Especially if she offered an ice cream or something. Then. And so this sloggy mind, often a sign of resistance, of reluctance, of not wanting to look at something or not wanting to deal with something. And sometimes in meditation it can be because deep semi-conscious stuff is bubbling up that you prefer to have kept in the basement. But you can't keep everything in the basement forever. So sooner or later you have to deal with it. But you protect yourself by sloth and torpor, by that kind of resistance. So sometimes if you notice a lot of sloth and torpor, you might look, what is it covering? What's really going on? Is there something deeper going on? But sometimes you won't find anything. It's just sloth and torpor. And then you've been warned, this is a normal part of meditation. You can expect this because you're a human being. You can expect this. And so there's not a reason to give up my meditation. It's not a reason to give up my interest in practicing. I've been told that this is where the mindfulness is supposed to be, the mindfulness of sloth and torpor. So you can again feel the physical sensations of it. It's fascinating to feel it. Go in there and kind of become the, like, imagine you have to write a dissertation on sloth and torpor. And you're like you're going to become the preeminent researcher, preeminent expert on what sloth and torpor feels like in a human being. So you're really happy when sloth and torpor appears because you have material to study. That's what you need. Otherwise, you'll never finish your dissertation. So you don't want to look, you know, make it happen. But you know, you don't have to feel like it's a problem. Just, oh, now I get to hang out with that. Now it's difficult sometimes with sloth and torpor and also with restlessness and agitation to continue meditating. One of the qualities, one of the inner strengths that we were developing as we meditate is patience. And you have to, without patience, you're not going to make it very far in life. And it's a very important quality for meditators to learn to be patient. Because if nothing else is happening during sloth and torpor, maybe you're learning patience. And patience means not giving in to the forces of aversion, not giving in to running away. And then restlessness and agitation. What does that cover? You know, it can cover all kinds of things. Conflict within ourselves, within people around us, not wanting to look at something. Fear. Restlessness is really a great thing to feel physically in the body. It's one of the best things to do when you're really restless in meditation, is to turn yourself over to your body. Imagine that your body is a pinball machine. And there's this pinball in there that's going around inside the confines of the box, of the body. And your job is sit completely still and just let that pinball kind of, or let the energy, let just kind of coast around and spin around and do whatever it's going to do. And don't interfere. But just let it kind of be held, in a sense, by the body. While you carefully feel how it is. What does it feel like, this? And what you'll probably find, if you do that, there's a couple of things. One is you develop patience. Another is you develop some capacity to be independent of your restlessness. You're not automatically caught by it, because you remove yourself slightly from it by having it just kind of happening freely in your body. And the third thing you might find is that if you just allow it to be there and just feel it within the body, that it tends to relax itself pretty quickly. And paradoxically, the more carefully you can feel it, the more closely you can get, just allow it to be there and feel it, the quicker the restlessness will dissipate, more often than not. Sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes a successful period of meditation, and if you sit for half an hour, you can know your meditation was successful. If that's a valid category, I don't know if it's valid to say that, but you know it's successful because you stayed on your cushion for the half an hour. You made it to the end. Sometimes I sit down to meditate. I've been doing this for over 25, close to 30 years now. And still to this day, there's some days I sit down. Yesterday, for example, I sat in the morning and I was really restless. I sat in the afternoon. I was very concentrated. It varies, you know, from day to day, how it goes up and down. But there are times when you sit down and it just feels like the rodeo in there. And now you've been told that's what you can expect sometimes. A successful meditation then is just making sure you don't leave the cushion. Nothing else matters. You don't have to get more concentrated, more calm, more anything. The fact that you managed to hang in there is really good when the restlessness is going to be really powerful. But if you learn to work with it and learn to get familiar with it and learn the skills of being in your body with it and studying it and looking at all the thoughts that come into play so you don't get seduced by them. Because often restlessness is all going to be bombarded with all kinds of thoughts and ideas at very fast pace. If you can learn to be independent of all these things and not believe them, then you can actually find a peaceful center, even with an agitated state. The last of the hindrances is doubt. And doubt is said to be the most dangerous. Because, and the reason it's supposed to be the most dangerous, is, they say, in Buddhism, is that doubt is the most convincing one for giving up the practice, for giving up. And there's all kinds of things you can doubt. Some people doubt themselves. I'm not up to this. I can't do this. You know, those the great meditators of the past, you know, they could do it, but me, you know, I'm just this average, sub-average, you know, whatever, from Palo Alto, who am I to enter the great domains of spirituality of the Buddha by sitting down and meditating? Who do I think I am? And, you know, full of doubt about our capacity, our ability. You can have doubts about anything. You can doubt the practice, you know, this, I'm not sure this is the right practice for me. I mean, this mindfulness stuff, I mean, it sounds like my mother saying, you know, pay attention, you know, and I should do something more ecstatic. You know, that's, you know, my spirituality is ecstasy, you know, maybe Sufi dancing is for me. You know, I'm not really sure what my, you know. And so there are all these doubts that can come into play about something external. Is this the right time? I don't think this is the right time to meditate. Maybe if I sit right after lunch, it's better. Lunch comes around. I don't know if this is quite right. Maybe at 5 o'clock this afternoon is better. And you say, I'm not sure. This is not done. I don't know. Maybe I'm not sure, you know. I'm not really sure. I think I'll kind of wait and see. Maybe before I go to sleep. And no, it doesn't really feel right now. I'm not sure. This is good. I'm sleepy. It doesn't seem right. And maybe tomorrow I'll try again. And so we're seduced by our doubt. Doubt is very, very powerful. It's very convincing. It usually comes with stories we make up. It has the characteristic of hesitation, of holding back. You know, we don't really commit ourselves or put ourselves into the meditation or into the practice. We're holding ourselves back, not sure what to do, uncertain. It's very helpful to be warned about doubt so that you know when doubt comes, you can recognize, oh, I've been told about this. Doubt, I've been told to expect the appearance of doubt. This is like a universal phenomenon that human beings have. They have doubt. I don't have to take it personally. That's what's great about all these five hindrances. You don't have to take them personally. They're human qualities everyone has. And since you don't take them personally, you don't have to believe them. Oh, it's doubt. And just simply saying, seeing it, oh, it's doubt. And then continuing with your practice. Or turn your attention into the doubt. You know, like turning your weight into your Aikido opponent. Feeling the doubt. What does the doubt feel like inside? Is there some level of restlessness going on inside of you? And feel the restlessness. Is there some pulling back? Is there some feeling of being split in your mind between two different forces, two different choices you have to make? And you're kind of struggling. And instead of struggling and instead of making a choice between two different things, what you do in mindfulness, you sit right in the middle at where the tension is between the two choices and hang out right there. And then you don't have any doubt because you know where to be, right at the tension, and then see what happens. So the five hindrances, desire, aversion, sloth, torpor, restlessness, agitation, and doubt. They are sure to visit you. That's for sure. And I encourage you to include them as part of your practice rather than as hindrances to your practice. Make them the wave that you ride rather than the cause of falling off a surfboard. That make sense? So now it's your turn. If you have any questions, yes.
fear fit in there? I have to have this knee operation, and I'm really afraid of it. And I watch, and I watch my thoughts, and I notice that's what they're all about. Various forms of, is this the right person to do it? Is it ever going to be right? Is it? And then I notice that what is underlying all that is fear. But then what? So there I am with fear.
Well, the same principles apply. I don't know if we need to kind of shoehorn fear into these five categories. We don't necessarily see them as being comprehensive. Everything fits under them. But the Buddhist tendency is to put fear under the category of aversion. It's a form of aversion.
Yeah, it is.
And so then to bring your attention to that, to bring your attention to the fear in your body, feel the fear in the body, the tension in the body that's associated with fear. And sometimes just feeling it in the body and recognizing it can take the power away from it. Look at the thoughts and notice, feel the doubt thoughts you have. And sometimes just looking at them can take some of the fuel away from the thoughts, and we can settle. With fear, sometimes it's useful to... There's a lot of strategies that Buddhists offer for fear besides just being mindful of it. One of them is to do loving kindness practice towards your fear or toward yourself. And maybe one of the things to do before surgery is loving kindness practice. Some people who do surgery feel kind of, you know, like helpless because everything's in the hands of the surgeon, you know, and they can screw it up. But you're just laying there waiting for it to happen. You know, you're just waiting in the hospital, you're waiting for the anesthesia or whatever, and laying there, and no one's told you that you can do anything. You're just supposed to kind of. But it can be very helpful for people to feel like they can do something during that time. And I've known a number of people who found it very helpful to do loving kindness meditation while they're waiting for surgery.
Because themselves.
Yeah. And I mean, probably it's a good idea to do it towards a surgeon, too. And sometimes having something to do like that can help with the fear.
Thank you.
Yes, Duncan.
He always said a successful meditation is when you basically keep seeing. I was wondering, in your own practice, are there instances or categories of thoughts that have come up where you just said, oh, I've got to get up for this, and, you know, I've gone to either do something or take care of something. I mean, I can think on the one hand, if there's an emergency or fire, clearly, you know, you might want to take care of something. But on a lesser example, suppose the thought comes up in your mind, oh my God, Alice might have misinterpreted that, and she's probably just torturing herself now with thinking I insulted her. I need to, you know, go call her. So on one hand, emergency, on the other hand, you know, minor conflicts that might be, and, you know, where do you draw the line, or how do you draw the line from, you know, getting up and interrupting the practice versus, you know, sitting through it?
Uh-huh. Well, you have to use your common sense, but when I sit in the morning, like if I have a regular morning sitting practice, that's kind of sacred. That's like whatever thought arises, and I'm going to sit no matter what, and not give in, because the mind is very tricky. The ego really will fool you all kinds of times, and it's really valuable to have one place where you're not going to give in to anything short of the house burning down or something. So it might, you know, that situation, it might be really useful to really stick with it. But if you sit other times of the day, for example, sometimes I sit in the afternoon, and it's happened to me in the last couple of weeks, where I sat down to meditate, and I realized, oh, I think I better do this thing before I meditate, and I'll get up and take care of the thing, and I have a phone call to make. You know, I promised I'd call someone back. Oh, I realized I better make that phone call, and then I'll go back and sit. So it kind of depends on the circumstances, but I put a lot of value on having a commitment, once you sit down, staying there to the end. So for me, it kind of depends on which sitting it is during the day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sometimes what I've found, I'll keep a pad of paper and just quickly jot a note to do this later and then write back to it. I found that helpful. I don't know, you know, I've often felt this kind of cheating, but...
With the hindrances, in the spirit of balance, is there something that could be said about some of them or all of them that can bring us deeper into practice, like the desire to sit is a type of desire,
yeah.
And how to work with that. Is there something with aversion or with doubt that we can find that it almost sometimes in working with these things, I get the sense of, oh, here's a desire, and then I start to have a little aversion toward it.
Oh, so I see.
Kind of
that's a good question. The not all desire is a hindrance. So it wasn't implying that every desire is a hindrance. In the list of the five hindrances, desire is one of them. Or desire sometimes takes the form of a hindrance. What we're trying to do is to overcome the hindering quality of desire. We don't necessarily try to stop having a desire. It's the hindering quality. So in working with something like desire or the five hindrances, you don't want to think that you're necessarily supposed to get rid of these things as if they're the problem. What we're trying to get rid of, in a sense, is the degree to which they cover up the present. So if you can be really present for the desire, you don't have to get rid of it. Does that make sense? So it's a very important point. So you're not at war with the desire trying to get rid of it. All you're trying to do overcome is the hindering quality of it. The way in which kind of it makes you fall off the wave. But if you can stay on the wave of the present moment, it's not a problem. But Allison's question was a little different. Are there times when desire itself helps us with our practice, keeps us on the path in a sense, keeps us on the wave? And certainly the desire to meditate, the desire to practice, to be mindful, is desire to have a spiritual life. It can be a beautiful part of who we are and something to be fed and nourished and followed through on. It doesn't have to be seen as a problem. There are times when the desire for practice is neurotic and maybe not, you know, maybe sometimes it's a little bit excessive or greedy or whatever, and you have to look at that. But it can, in its purity, it can be a beautiful thing and can help us keep going. So desire is pretty obvious. With aversion, I think there can be a kind of healthy aversion, healthy turning away, healthy kind of saying, this is not good for me. You know, I'm not good. This is not really healthy for me or healthy for other people. I'm not going to pursue this. I'm going to walk away from this kind of behavior, this kind of thoughts, these kinds of feelings. You might notice that if you spend a lot of time gossiping, that it kind of creates poison around you or in the community. And after a while, you realize, boy, this is just simply not worth it. I'm going to turn away. I'm going to act on this aversion. Aversion, it doesn't have to have ill will in it. It just means it's a wise kind of turning away. Not this. It can be very wise. It can be a lot of energy behind it. Not this, not now. It can be a sign of self-respect to turn away from certain behaviors and certain patterns. Not now. But it should be done wisely. Is that approximately what you had in mind?
And doubt too?
Oh, there's lots of doubt. Doubt doesn't have to be a hindrance. Doubt doesn't have to be a cause for losing the present moment. Some doubts actually can keep you in the present moment. And so you have to be able to differentiate between those doubts that are a hindrance that keep you from falling off the wave, those doubts that kind of cause you to fall off the surfboard, and those doubts that keep you on. One of the great doubts in Buddhist practice is you never want to settle for anything as if you finally understood what it is. So, you know, you always want, you know, what is? You're not sure what it is. What is this? There's doubt. What is this? I don't really know what it is. What is it? Always trying to get to know better. You know, what is this? The last thing you want to do in Buddhism is to come to some definitive conclusion. Now you know. So it's a healthy doubt. Yes, please.
Mostly, I guess I was thinking that sometimes the aversion, or I mean the hindrance, or what comes up for me sometimes, I think it's sort of an aversion to boredom. So, or there's some kind of fear that I'm going to be bored, or sort of like a dislike of thinking I'm going to have to be in some sort of deprivation situation. So I think maybe sometimes when I start doing the breathing thing, I start paying attention to it, but at first I have a slight feeling like, well, gee, is this going to be a real... Aren't I going to feel sort of like it's kind of a cut off from everything? That I'm just doing this or something? That's like a thought would pass through my mind. But I think what you said today has helped a lot in seeing how you can work with the, like you said, thinking what is it that makes you stray from the concentration and then see what those are.
That's great. You said that. And boredom is a very subtle, is a form of aversion.
Yeah.
And boredom is a doing, something we do that often keeps us from really being intimate and present for how things actually are. And it's very important not to give in to boredom, but actually turn around and look at it, and look at what we're afraid of.
Right.
What we're afraid of.
And I think paradoxically, I'm usually a person who thinks that I never am bored. So, but then once in a while, I'll be in a situation like the work I do sometimes is so. It'd be the one situation where I sometimes feel like, God, this is boring. And then I'm going, God, and I'm the guy who used to go around saying, oh, I'm never bored. It was sort of calling my own bluff.
I remember when I was first introduced to this practice in Thailand. I practiced for intensely for, I don't remember how long now, but maybe 7-8 weeks on retreat. And then for some reason my meditation teacher took me with him into Bangkok for the funeral of some Thai general. And I don't know what business I had to be at the funeral of a Thai general. It's, you know, a completely gaudy Thai temple. It looked like, you know, something out of Disneyland or something. And it was all the proceedings were going on in Thai. I couldn't understand anything. And it would have been on and on and on. And I was getting bored and bored. And suddenly it dawned on me, wait a minute. I know what to do. I pay attention. And so I started doing mindfulness, paying attention to what's going on, you know, being mindful, being really mindful of what's happening. And my boredom went away like that. I think if we want to have our short sitting, we can maybe have more questions afterwards.
You've seen people from starting out over the years. You just mentioned 7 to 8 weeks when you were starting out. I know everybody's different, but is there like a time period you should give it before you you give up? Should you keep practicing?
mean you want to how long you should give it in order to see some results? So you
not I know that results are relative, so everybody's different or something, whatever. Maybe you have this in mind, I'm going to keep doing it for 2 weeks, 3 weeks, and no matter what. If after that I still can't, don't feel like it, I can make that decision.
Oh, the question is whether it's useful to have some kind of commitment to a certain length of time.
When you're starting out.
It can be, it can be, because the mind is very tricky. It can lose interest, it could have aversion, it can get restless, it can get bored, it can get frightened of what's coming up. It can be impatient with the discomfort when we get uncomfortable in meditation. It's all kinds of things that the mind can do. It can throw up the obstacles in a sense. And sometimes having a commitment to see it through is really helpful. So I'm going to be sitting for the next month no matter what, and then reevaluate after a month can be a valuable thing to do for sure. I tend to believe that it's useful to in some ways, I think, in terms of a time frame, if you're new to meditation, or if you're not new to meditation, if you do a regular meditation practice of, say, you sit for half an hour every morning or every day, and you do it for 6 months, pretty much every day, 6 days a week at least, take Sundays off, and then after 6 months, stop for 2 or 3 weeks, stop cold, just completely stop. And then notice the difference in your life. Because some of the benefits of meditation, some of the ways in which it affects us, kind of creep up, they're kind of slow. And then slowly, kind of like slowly over the days and the weeks and the months, so there's a slow change and transformation. And that, but you don't really see it because you're living in the middle of it. And then, but then if you stop suddenly for 2 or 3 weeks, or 1 or 2 weeks, then you might notice, wow, you know, it really helps my day a lot. I tend to get much more tense in the course of the day, or I tend to act much more unconsciously. And so sometimes having a little experiment after 6 months can be good.
That brings up another small question. I was reading in one book that if you look out for any benefit, that's you can consider that one of the hindrances. Just a hindrance. If you start looking, am I, is anything happening? Then I guess that creates doubt.
Yeah. It's best not to be looking for, while you're meditating. You know, in the meditation session itself, it's best not to look for any benefits. Just matter-of-factly do the practice, kind of with complete faith or trust. All you're supposed to do is be present. If you're looking for something, you're in trouble. If you're looking for benefits, but when you get out of meditation, you kind of evaluate kind of the bigger picture. Sometimes it's useful to look and see: am I benefiting from this? You know, is this helping me? And you know,
okay,
sure. So let's just take 2 minutes to just sit quietly. The hindrances are sometimes coverings for things within us which need our love. And one of the highest forms of love is attention. May you bring attention to that which is within. Thank you all, and I wish you all a wonderful week.